In association with Newsarama.com, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. It's going to be a multi-episode week because I've just got back from the FX International Show in Orlando, Florida. A wonderful weekend featuring a lot of comic book people, and I got the chance to moderate some of the panels. I'll be bringing you the audio from those panels. We start today with two creators from the Vertigo line, Brian Wood and Brian Azzarello. Brian Azzarello comes back for his third Word Balloon interview and is just as surly as he was in my first talk. But the great thing is, after that initial awkwardness that I know Azzarello enjoys to put me through, we settle down into a good rhythm. And you'll hear a lot about 100 Bullets, Loveless, Deathblow, a lot of books from Brian, and also his thoughts on continuity versus, I think, some of the artistic freedom that he's given at Vertigo. Dealing with his own characters. Brian Wood is a guy that I've been trying to get on Word Balloon since first falling in love with his work at Demo, also Local, and now talks about his books Northlanders, the Viking book, and also from Vertigo, DMZ, that very interesting civil war that's happening in America with its own parallels to the conflicts that our country finds itself in internationally. Really two introspective writers whose work I've always enjoyed. And it was really a pleasure to get behind the scenes with them and really hear about their thoughts, not only on their books, but just about writing in general and in comic books in general. A neat conversation, and I think you're going to enjoy it. Word Balloon is brought to you by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades offers a huge selection of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more. They're all at up to 35% off, with orders over $50 receiving free shipping. Right now, you'll find many of Brian Azzarello's 100 Bullets trades, which sell regularly for $14.99. They're only $9.74 at InStockTrades.com. Plus, Brian Wood's DMZ trades retail for $12.99, just $8.44 at InStockTrades. And don't forget to visit their sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, at DCBService.com for all your pre-order needs. Major publishers are 40% off, and monthly specials are 45 to 75% off every month. Visit InStockTrades and InStockTrades.com and Discount Comic Book Service at DCBService.com.
I'm John Suntress. I host a podcast online. It's called Word Balloon. I'm very happy to be moderating this panel because, truly, these are two of my favorite writers. Brian Azzarello, of course, of 100 Bullets fame, Loveless, two fine Vertigo books, and, of course, Brian Wood, who has a multitude of books, but currently Northlanders and DMZ. It's great to see both of you, and I want to start because... Well, first, it's interesting because you both represent two different, I don't know if era is the right word, but basically two different phases of Vertigo. I mean, Brian Azzarello, you're part of the second wave, I think. Is that a fair?
Sure, John.
Okay, there you go. Thanks a lot. There you go. Always helpful. You think of Vertigo and where it started with Neil Gaiman and that stuff, and it really was, I think, 100 Bullets that, to me, was one of the first realistic series to come from Vertigo. So, as you're nearing the end of the series,
yeah,
we're about to start the final 11 or so, or
yeah, the final year.
Obviously, everybody reads 100 Bullets. Wonderful book. Fantastic.
Wonderful. I've never heard it described as wonderful before.
What can you tell us without spoiling anything in terms of these final 12?
Nothing. You don't want me to tell you anything, do you? I mean, you want to read it. That's why you buy the damn things.
Yeah. Excellent. There you go. Good start. Brian Wood, let me ask you. DMZ, it, to me, represents the same kind of work you were doing with Channel Zero in terms of its realism. You've taken it to a new level by having the Civil War happening in the United States. So many parallels to what's going on right now with our wars abroad. And the thing I liked about your work is the influence of the media and the way people perceive current events. I would imagine every day there's got to be new ideas coming out for you in terms of what to put into DMZ.
Yeah, that's kind of the reason why I've not locked myself into a definite end date or a set number of issues for the book. It's like you said, there's, you know, potential material for it, you know, every day, and so I want to be able to keep on going if I want to. So, and thankfully, Vertigo's not asked me to, like, set an end date or even say how the series ends, which is really, really good, because I don't know.
Well, and who are the editors for both of your books? Brian Azzarello, who's...
Will Dennis.
Who it is? Okay, yeah. Will is for both of you guys. And I'm assuming Will pretty much lets you guys do whatever you want. I mean, this is... I mean,
these whatever are, we want. Yeah.
Well, really. I mean, has there been a case where you guys have been told, no, you can't...
Well, no, Will's a pretty weak editor, I think. I mean, he doesn't have much of a spine. This is a podcast, right?
It's yeah, oh, yeah. Oh, this is...
Yeah, okay.
Excellent. This is consistent with our other interviews, Bryce, so by all means.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, there's not a lot of input from Will because, I frankly, I don't think he's very bright.
No, have there been times where he said, I mean, Vertigo seems to be where you guys can do pretty much whatever you want as opposed to the DC universe. I mean, are there areas that you've wanted to go into where it's like, yeah, I don't know, man. I don't know if corporate's going to let us
to comfort zone.
Yeah.
Then, well, that's what it's called.
Okay.
And yeah, there's times when you get out of the comfort zone.
Okay.
As it were.
Have you gotten any flack for anything that you've covered so far in 100 Bullets? Has any...
Editorially?
Even outside groups coming out and say, I can't believe you people publish this nonsense. What, you know, how dare you?
No, just my parents. No, not really. When I was working on Hellblazer, that was the one time editorial was a little... nervous about something.
Okay.
So...
Cool. I'm going to get the Loveless Duke, by the way.
Okay. No, that one's flying, like, no problem.
All right, man.
I'm just crazy.
and Wood? I should really just call you Az or Az and Wood, if I may.
I think that's what Will calls us.
All right, there you go. Yeah.
No one's ever told me I shouldn't write something or I should change anything because they were worried about anything. I think the difference between Brian here being in the second wave and me being in whatever wave I'm in is that he's not afraid to make fun of Will. But I'm still afraid. I haven't gotten to that point.
I'm not making fun of Will. I'm just, you know, I like
you see it.
The truth. I mean, that's all it is.
It took, I think Will turned down 7 or 8 of my pitches before DMZ.
Really?
DMZ. So it was hard for me to get in. But once... You know, now it's fine. I mean, it's pretty smooth sailing. Everybody's really, really nice.
That's cool.
Yeah.
It's not an easy imprint to get.
That's very true.
In on. I mean, same for me. I mean, it took years.
Well, and I know you both have said publicly in various articles that you're not comfortable. You know, Brian, as I know, you've done a couple superhero stories, and I think you told me you're kind of through the last time we talked.
I kind of threw up.
No. Well, I mean, well, and I should say, Dr. 13 was an awesome comedy, and I really, really enjoyed it. And it's funny because I remember asking you, you know, are we going to stay consistent with what we know about Dr. 13, and you immediately said, what do you know about Dr. 13? Because it was this, like Johnny Double, this kind of blip of a character that you really kind of took your own way. And I know the great thing is I talked to guys like Jeff Johns who, you know, clearly were at the other end of your satire there. They loved it. I know they were laughing and stuff, and it really enjoyed. Did you guys read Dr. 13? That was it's so funny. And really, if you like what's happening in the DCU, this...
If you don't like what's happening in the DCU...
No, I think you will, actually. I think you will. For people who haven't read it,
Yeah, no, please read it.
Do you want to tell them a little bit about it?
It's a bunch of characters that DC didn't have any use for during...
Not C-level, like Z-level.
Yeah. During 52 is when I wrote it.
And if you've been reading Booster Gold, I think Jeff kind of has, you know, shown how much he appreciated the joke because they've popped up a couple times, a panel here and a panel there, the same group of characters. And it's a really cool, it's a cool parody. And also, as I got to say, Deathblow. Loving Deathblow.
Loving the Deathblow.
Loving the Deathblow from Wildstorm. No, and you know, it was, I remember when, didn't you do with... Bermejo,
yeah.
8 years ago. I remember that story, and I read that in the collection and really enjoyed that, but this is such a great different take, and again, a nice, funny satire of, you know, in a very violent way.
Yeah, violent, funny satire.
It's a funny, violent satire. I'm enjoying it. It's that first wave of Wildstorm books that they announced with the Authority and everything, you know, there were so many creative problems, and meanwhile, the guys who were able to come out with books, you and Christos Gage and Gail, are, you know, the ones seriously carrying the water and doing some really fun stories. Is this event that's happening in Wildstorm, is that going to affect what's going on with Deathblow?
What event?
Yeah, I don't even know what it's called now, quite frankly. It's whatever Christos has been working on, so maybe
not. Oh, no. That has nothing to do with
it. Cool.
No, Deathblow is pretty much, it's become a standalone series. I don't think it fits into the continuity at all.
Okay. Very cool. And what, I got to do that so that we can distinguish Wood as Northlanders, Viking series, and given again so many of your series that deal with current events and I think current social issues, I think people were surprised when they heard the announcement. Two issues have come out, and I see a lot of modern characterization in Sven and in some of his interaction that I've noticed, but you know, why Vikings?
Well, it's a couple things. Our editor Will asked me to pitch a new book, but to really just as he said, don't do what I'm comfortable with. So that was part of it. And then I was also talking to a DCU editor, and we were like flipping through whatever that book is called, of all the, like, the handbook or the...
Who's who?
Yeah, we're just trying to find anything that I could possibly do. And there was that Viking Prince.
Sure.
Which, yeah, I didn't do. But it just got me thinking about Vikings. So it just kind of came from there. I asked Will if I could pitch it, because I assumed I couldn't. Or I assumed he'd be like, you know, that's way too far out of your comfort zone. But he was like, I don't know, I can try it, you know. So I tried it, and it was really easy. Like, no one really said, no one ever, like, questioned it, like, why I was doing it. So I was just like, okay, here I go. It was approved in probably, like, three or four months, and Brian knows that's pretty quick.
Yeah. There was a sequence at the beginning of the second issue where Sven is talking to an elderly couple and finding out the conditions of his home world and heading back and, you know, very Shakespearean that he's going back to kind of reclaim the throne, basically, and the leadership of his people, but... I really liked the whole idea, and it sounded like a teenager kind of going back and, you know, who's been out in the real world or in different parts and kind of explored things, and this old couple telling him, oh, you know, you may want to stay once you're back. And he's kind of like, yeah, I don't think so. And it really did. It felt like a typical 20-year-old kind of saying, no, man, I want to see the world. You know, or if you go back to It's a Wonderful Life, like, you know, to hell with Bedford Falls. I'm going to see the world.
Yeah, so who doesn't want to see the world? I don't know.
So that's kind of timeless, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's popped up in a couple of books I've done, to one degree or another. It's not. I mean, I didn't like draw on my own life, but I mean, I left for Vermont because I didn't want to live in a, you know, place like that. You know, now I want to, which I think is maybe where that old couple in Northland is coming from. You know. As I age gracefully, I start to miss places like that.
That's cool. Now, as Loveless, much like maybe Brian reading seeing the Viking Prince and getting the inspiration from that, you have done your El Diablo series a couple years back, and you know, I remember my first conversation with you was when you were talking about Loveless, and you said, you know, hey, I'm looking forward to doing this Western, and you've described Loveless as kind of a Western noir.
Yeah.
That's cool. I noticed in the previews that, I mean, the story starts in the post-Civil War time, and I noticed coming up in either, I want to say April or May, you're going to kind of move the story up a little bit and have the early 1900s?
Yeah, the next three issues are going to take place in... 1920s, okay. Like early 1900s, and then the late 1880s.
That's cool.
Yeah. It's just seeing where some of these characters end up.
Well, you're fleshing out this cool little Western universe. I also like the what's happening in 100 Bullets. What I've always enjoyed about 100 Bullets is that you've, within the mega story. You've also had these great little interludes of just every kind of noir story you could think of. The Carter Fifth Detective is still one of my favorite stories, and I really enjoyed the blue story as well. The guy with the horn. I'm trying to remember which. I think it was the sixth. Was it the sixth collection?
Eighth. Eighth.
Thank you.
It was the hard way.
Yeah, eighth hour. Yeah, there you go. Exactly. I want to throw things up to you guys if you guys have any questions about their stories. I've got more questions for them, but really, I mean, this is an opportunity for you guys to really get a chance to talk to them and see what they'll tell you.
Are you? I know you only have two issues in Northlanders. Are you going to try to keep it in that Viking era, or are you going to bring it back to Constantine? I know Sven mentioned he's been in Constantine, but he's been in the real world, the fun parts of the world. And are you going to try to bring it back there, or are you
going to
keep it?
Well, I don't want to give too much away. The fifth-ish issue is a flashback, which kind of shows Sven as a child leaving and going there. So at the very least, that ish issue is going to take place there. Beyond that. Each arc of the series is going to skip around a bit in time, although it's all kind of staying within, you know, those few hundred years that, you know, it's like the Viking Age. Becky Clinton really wants me to write a Black Death plague story for her to try to draw, which is like way out of the Viking Age, but I don't know, maybe if Northlanders goes long enough, I can figure out a way to encompass that.
That's cool. I'm looking forward to the collection that Vertigo is going to do with Demo. I enjoyed it when it came out issue by issue, and I wanted to ask both of you about the artists you do work with. I want to start with you, because where do you find, I mean, Eduardo Risso certainly had a pedigree that we were all aware of. If people who like, you know, international comics certainly were aware of Eduardo Risso, but Marcello Frusen? Am I saying it right?
Marcello
Frusen. Yeah, please. Now, where'd you find Marcello?
Or did Wilhelm? He was Eduardo's assistant.
For real? Yeah, hilarious. All right, that's funny. Well, so you didn't reach that far.
No, that was easy.
That's cool. And Brian, I mean, the guys you're working with, and Becky, of course?
Becky I found online. She had a couple of web comics up on her site, and this is like 1999 or 2000 or something. Ricardo and Davide are just came out of a giant pile of portfolios that Will had in his office, which he's taken a couple trips over there and just brought back samples. And it was, you know, it's a boring story. We just like sifted through books. That's what we found.
Okay.
These guys.
Yes, I got to ask you. I got to ask you about one guy that he's not hard to find, but it had to be cool working with him on Sergeant Rock, and that's Kubert. I mean, the man, not Adam and Andy, no offense to Adam and Andy, but the father, the original, and that's, I really enjoyed that story, and it's going to give me an opportunity to talk to both of you guys about war books, because, you know, what was that like? I mean, did you have the script? Did he have the plot? How did Rock and a Hard Place?
We had a meeting over lunch. I told him what the direction I wanted to go with the characters, and he said what he wanted was to flesh these characters out, that they never really had a chance to have a, you know, singular voices back when they were originally published. So, you know, I took what he wanted and turned it into a story, I guess.
Okay.
You know.
Those, you know, I love those showcase collections of those war books.
And all the showcases, I don't care what it is. You know, even something goofy like the Metal Men, I mean, those things are fantastic.
the war stories, though, in particular, I mean, first of all, obviously, Russ Heath art, Joe Kubert art, you can't go wrong. But yeah, I have to say, for 8 and 11 page stories, they put a lot of, I mean, they really knew how to, you know, use that small space and then, you know, convey a quick little story and stuff. Like you say, I mean, it probably wasn't until you had the opportunity to flesh out the Easy Company characters that they really weren't kind of just supporting people for Rock, but, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you read those stories, most of them are, you know, because of the space constraint, they're all very much plot driven.
Sure.
You know, and God, they're like 8-9 panels a page, and half those panels are caption box.
Yeah.
So, You know, there's really not a lot of opportunity for those characters to define themselves through what they say. We had room to do that.
Are there other DC war characters that you would like to try and write?
Unknown Soldier, probably.
Everybody loves the Unknown Soldier.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, you can't help it, man. It's bandaged face and everything. No, it was one of my favorites, and that was one of my favorite showcases when it came out. And I got to talk to David Michelinie about writing the end of that run as well. And I think that's an awesome character. Brian Wood, what about you? And any of those characters appeal to you, maybe?
I like the Unknown Soldier, of course. No, I think I've always had a really hard time. I think a big part of the reason why I haven't done a lot of company books is I just don't have a clue, you know, what to do. I was talking to Brian about it, you know, yesterday. Say how, like, I'm not a guy who grew up reading comics.
So I was going to ask, okay.
I don't have, it's not like I have, like, the Fantastic Four story I've been dying to write for 20 years in my head.
Okay.
So it's all kind of new to me. I mean, I couldn't even tell you the names of the Fantastic Four, to be honest.
What comics do you enjoy reading? More independent stuff and everything? I mean,
I don't really read as much as I have in the past. I think it's like, I think writing comics is like seeing how hot dogs are made,
yeah.
You know, it's an elusive after a while. I've said this until, yeah, I'm blue in the face, but everybody should be reading Scalped. I think that's my favorite book. I follow writers more than anything else. Like, I read Garth Ennis's books and, you know, Grant Morrison stuff. You know.
That's cool.
Punisher Max, which I guess is coming to an end, at least.
Yes.
Garth's part of it's like extremely sad, because I think that's that and Scalp, I think, is what I look forward to the most.
That's cool. As any you were a comic reader, weren't you?
Not really.
No.
No.
Wow, man.
Well, not superhero comics. I mean,
that's really interesting. Because, you know, I always tell you, one of my favorite superhero stories you did was Tangled Web, and you finally tell Crusher Hogan's story, the wrestler that took on Spider-Man. And, I love that story. And it just, you know, really kind of fleshed out the origin in a fun way.
Well, it wasn't about Spider-Man.
Well, but still.
That's what made it a good Spider-Man story.
Nice.
Well, you know, Lex Luthor's a good Superman story because Superman's not in it.
Yeah, you know, Man of Steel is, you know, what the issue in particular that I really enjoyed of that run was the lunch between Bruce Wayne and Lex Luthor, where really you just had the subtext of the two of them as they're eating, and especially Lex just looking across and like, this guy's an idiot. I mean, he's got money, he's just, you know, it was great. It really, you know, for a guy that doesn't, you know, follow the DCU, you seem to, you know, grab these guys pretty fast, and you spoke with their voices pretty well.
Well, you strip them down to what, you know, the essence of the character. You know, you don't, continuity is such baggage, at least, you know, in my perspective. It just kills these characters that, you know, you have to be beholden to all this stuff that's really kind of unnecessary. And, you know, the most important thing is telling a good story. That's number one. And you know, Brian, what you were saying about how, you know, it's difficult to care about him. Yeah, it's difficult to care about him and to get involved in that kind of stuff, because it's almost impossible to tell a good story with some of these characters anymore. I mean, there's too many constraints on them, you know, from editorially. It's like you can do certain things and you can't do other things. And, you know, I've said it before, this is not new. Superman being married was like, who the hell thought that was a good idea? I mean, because it totally cuts something that makes that character so vital. You know, the Clark and the sort of like the, I mean, because it, like I said, you strip them down to what they are. What is the Superman Lois Lane Clark Kent relationship? It's a love triangle. And it's not that anymore. And so it's lost any sort of power. There's no tension there.
And no opportunity to introduce a new woman. Greg Rucka, in his Adventures of Superman run, I thought introduced an interesting female cop that wasn't impressed with Superman and certainly seemed to be a woman that, if he were free, would have been someone to probably even say, hey, I'm going to try and bag this guy and everything. And it was, we were denied that because of the marriage. And I think you're right.
Yeah.
You know, and even Lana, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, throw another triangle in there, Superman, Lois, and Lana, too. So
who's Lana?
I'm serious. Who's Lana Lang?
Oh, okay. I thought she was Jimmy Olsen's girlfriend.
That's Chloe. You're thinking of the...
No, it's...
That's Lucy.
Is it Lucy? Okay.
Lucy Lang.
Okay.
Wade would be like, you know...
Oh, Brian. Jimmy, that's a character I'd really love to get my hands on.
Lana Lang?
No, Jimmy.
Jimmy?
Yeah.
Hey, Joe, I'm very bummed. I got to tell Joe how bummed I was that Solo didn't continue. You guys, Jill Thompson and Brian are together, and Will Pfeiffer was going to write a story for Jill's Solo, and it was going to be a Jimmy Olsen story. I know Will was looking forward to that.
Sam.
Yeah. He said we could tell. We have new people, so yeah, if you have any questions for the guys, I will be happy to throw it open to anyone who has any questions. We can keep rolling.
Okay.
By all means, man. Sure.
You talk about your editorial process. You have an editor who's... You have seen that in some of your books you have three of you certain things on which you have to clamp down. I was thinking about Broken City, where you kind of reimagine Killer Croc in a really interesting way.
I didn't reimagine Killer Croc, I don't think. I think I went back to Croc's roots.
Okay. But we certainly, he wasn't portrayed as that style in a very long time. So to me, it was like...
Right, it was sort of like the way he was originally created. It was, you know, he was a circus freak. A mean circus freak.
I'm just wondering if you have, how difficult it is to work with, is it easier in Vertigo than is the main DCU?
Absolutely. Absolutely, it's easier to work at Vertigo than it is in the main DCU as far as editorial constraints are. And if you're doing a creator-owned book, you really don't have very many constraints at all because you're, you know, it's your story. And you're beholden to your own continuity. You know, I was joking about Will. Will's not really a weak editor. I can't really think of the word, but it's not weak. No, he's really strong. He's got great ideas. It's good to work for somebody like Will because he's challenging in a way. And that's really what you need out of your editor. And I've always said to people, it's like, you know, who do you write for? It's like, I write for my editor because he signs my voucher. And he really is the first, he's your first audience as a writer, you know. So you got to trust him. If you know, you make a misstep somewhere, he's got to catch it for you.
Is there much of a difference between Will and Axel Alonso, who was your...
Well, Will's about eight inches shorter than Axel.
Nice. Very nice. Brian Wood, you've dabbled with superpowers in demo, and you know, is there a superpower Vertigo story in you? Do you think at some point, or another publisher? I don't know. Are you exclusive to?
Yeah, okay. I am. For at least the next like 8 months or so.
Okay.
I don't know what's gonna happen then. I don't know. I mean, I leave everything open. I mean, I don't mean to like dismiss that I'll never write like a company book or anything. I've tried a couple times. I've had things offered to me that I didn't like. So it's, I'm sure it'll happen eventually. What it's going to be or when, I don't even know. So.
Do you know? I want to ask about DMZ. Do you know any reporters that have been embedded? I mean, where are you getting your ideas for the portrayal?
I just read a lot of books, a lot of books.
Arthur Kent, the Stud, and people like that.
I haven't read that one.
Okay. That was the first Gulf War guy.
There are a lot of books. I think when I first was doing research, and I was just like poking around bookstores, there was really like a wealth of books written during like the Bosnian War.
Yeah.
And also like a lot of books on Chechnya, which I think at least initially that was where I was getting my ideas from more than like, you know, American wars.
Have you had an opportunity to meet Joe Sacco and ever talk to him about...
I've met Joe, but it was before I began this book.
Okay.
He's great.
Yeah.
I think...
You guys know Joe Sacco? Great independent guy who does basically reportage in comic book form.
It's really like travels to, you know, Afghanistan, and I don't know if it's been Afghanistan.
No, but I know it's...
Palestine and to Bosnia.
And Bosnia and Sarajevo.
Yeah, yeah.
And also did a great rock and roll book as well.
Yeah.
So, no, he's a very cool reporter. And he's done a few the Piranha Press stuff. Or maybe not. I thought he did. I thought he was in a couple of those big books, but maybe not, because it's a similar style.
Right.
And as I know, you're you do a lot of research for Loveless, and I know I've read that.
Yeah, I know a cowboy.
You talked to Roy Rogers, and I got the full story from him. That's lovely. No, is there, you know, were there specific histories that, you know, informed your...
Mostly what, yeah, I'd say going online and finding sites that had published letters from soldiers, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
That's, you know, getting history firsthand, that kind of... was what I was after, because Reconstruction is pretty much a kind of a glossed over part of our history.
Absolutely.
It's nothing that, the only consistent thing about American history, I think, is that if it's something embarrassing, we're not going to hear about it. You know, we just would rather not talk about it, which is, you know, it's like everybody's family, you know?
Are you finding parallels to the problems of today in when you're looking at the period of Reconstruction? And
yeah, you know that what's that? The history repeats itself.
Well, yeah,
it sure does, man. It's crazy. I mean, it's just like some of the things that you know, mistakes that we've made in the past, we just continue to make. You know. This is not the last time we will be involved in a war that we shouldn't be involved in.
Well, I don't want to talk to that about that as well, because you guys are, again, you put a lot of contemporary ideas in your books, and it's funny how Hollywood has tried to do a few films about the Iraq conflict, and, you know, it's interesting that the audience doesn't seem to be supporting them. And these are, you know, some quality filmmakers and interesting films, also some schlocky films as well, but... you know, I don't. Have you guys seen any of the, you know, in the Valley of Allah and
Jarhead?
Well, yeah, Jarhead's the schlocky one that I was thinking. Was it good? Was Jarhead good?
Nah.
It looked kind of schlocky to me. And the one with Reese Witherspoon screaming because her husband Remender. But yeah, Rendition. Yeah, you guys see any of that or?
No, I have a kid. I don't see movies. that independent George Clooney one. What was that called?
Michael Clayton?
Syriana?
Oh, Syriana. Yeah.
That was good.
Yeah, I thought that was really good.
I wonder if... I always make this joke, and I always wonder how true it is. I wonder if no one... Like you said, these films aren't well received. I wonder if it's like massive subconscious guilt on the part of Americans.
Yeah, or they're, you know... Well, and I like what you said in one of the articles I read online, Wood, that, you know, you're just kind of... disappointed how the way the war is being portrayed on television, and we're becoming desensitized to it
in the news.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was that way in the first Gulf War, which is that, you know, I was 18 at the time, and that had a big impact on me. It was, I remember, and this actually happened in both of the Iraq wars, working in an office, and everybody in like the break room watching TV of the initial, you know, bombings and shock and awe and everything. And it was just sort of like, you're just like watching it, and like, you know, you're upset about it or whatever, but then you just go back to work. You know, I almost wish we couldn't watch it. Seems like I don't really know if I'm making my point, but it seems like the more it's treated as so common on the news, the easier it is just to stop watching it.
Yeah, you become more detached.
You watch footage of, like, you know, like actual film reel footage of the Vietnam War, and that feels 10 times more real to me than if I turn on, like, you know, CNN and see, like, you know, whatever.
All we get to see really now is a reporter standing in, you know, with the skyline behind him.
Yes.
You know, that's...
Well, and the difference, I think, with Vietnam was, too, you had a lot of editorial voices in the field, and you really did get the CBS perspective versus the NBC perspective. Now, with pool coverage, you really are just getting the government's message, plus just the lack of funding, I think, by these media companies to really keep bureaus active in the various theaters. You're just getting guys that are going from London to, or whatever European hub they're based in, to then, like you say, stand in front of really just, you know, a backdrop and not really stay embedded. And the ones that are embedded and that do come back, you do get their stories. But I think there's corporate control, and I do think there's government control of what we're allowed to see. As
really, you think
well,
so?
Well, yeah. I was gonna state the obvious about how, from not even being able to photograph caskets coming home. I mean, that's the kind of horror that they are desensitizing us to, and that's why it's interesting to, you know, see something like DMZ, for example, would, because not only is it showing you the horror, but also taking it one step further and really putting it in our backyards.
There was a line I put, I think, in the second DMZ trade, talking about how, you know, once upon a time reporters actually, like, you know, sought stories out. You know, like you're saying now, they just get briefed and just, like, repeat it back to us, which is obviously a real shame.
Yeah. Sir?
I think that's the great thing of the industry. I mean, you know, if you're just an aspiring writer and you would like to do something similar to what you're doing, how would you say, what's the best way to
get published?
Yeah.
Isn't it a shitty answer, but that's really the answer?
The only answer. Yeah.
Do you guys think online is making it easier for people to find work? That's more of a question, I think, for Will, if he were here. But, you know, do you think putting your stuff online is a good idea, or what do you
think? I certainly think it's viable. It's better than not doing anything, you know? Yeah, the easiest way to get an editor to look at your work is to show them something that another editor bought, because it's proof that you're not a flake.
And also, even if you fake it and, like, self-publish a book, as long as it's like this, it just shows that you can, like, follow through on a project. Like, not just, like, post a bunch of pages online, but you, like, finish the book and it's lettered and it's stapled and it's, like, a readable thing. I always tell everybody to physically mail in samples to editors as opposed to just emailing a link. I've been told anyway by editors that they're a lot more likely to flip through like a zine or whatever that's on their desk than they are to, like, click a link in a random email from someone that they don't know.
And I don't know if you guys remember, but I know Az was, you know, with us smaller publishers before obviously getting to Vertigo and DC. I mean, Now and Kimiko, and right? I remember Chicago companies specifically just because I'm from Chicago, and I know when Az came to Chicago, that trail. And Brian, did you self-publish, Brian?
It was sort of it wasn't anything that was ever distributed.
Okay.
A bunch of friends of mine from the school self-published a comic book under, like, a fake company name, just to have samples to, like, mail around.
Sure.
We never actually tried to do anything with it. It cost a lot of money. But that's what Paul Pope did, too, with his Horse Press, except he actually did.
Okay.
But,
AIT, like, when I remember your first stuff. Go ahead, please. That was my first stuff that I noticed of yours.
Actually, it was Image first.
Oh, okay.
I actually had given Image a copy of one of his self-published books, and they wanted it, which is but it took like three and a half years of sending that around before anybody wanted it. So it's I always tell everybody it's patience is just as important in breaking in as anything else.
Yeah, persistence is pretty good.
And
the other thing, if you just... Do you want to write comics or do you want to write? You better have, the answer better be the second one, because otherwise you're probably not going to do either. You know, I mean, you've got to be driven. If you want to be a writer, you have to be driven to write. It doesn't matter what you're writing. You know, because otherwise, I mean, you're just somebody looking to contribute to your hobby, you know, beyond a reader. I wrote videos, actually. So,
what kind of videos?
Industrial videos.
Yeah. And I know you were a painter at one point as well.
I was a painter. I restored antique furniture. I've done demolition. I've been a janitor. And all those experiences led me right here up on this stage.
I asked you once in one of our first interviews about dialogue, because that is, to me, one of the great things about 100 Bullets, even, and Loveless, for that matter, as well. And it's, I would ask you, where would it be those source letters that dictate the dialogue of Loveless, or is it just, again, the observations that you've told me before in terms of 100 Bullets, of just kind of hanging in the city and just being a listener and picking up on people's conversations?
Loveless, I kind of had to invent a new language for, because the sentence structures of those letters, I mean, they're easy to read, they're almost impossible to say. I mean, the way people spoke back then, it just is not the same way that we put sentences together right now, today. So I kind of had to take, you know, a modern sensibility and throw it back on those, that kind of stuff.
And Wood, I would ask you the same question about Northlanders. I mean, I don't see any tapes rolling around of Vikings having these. There are no podcasts of Vikings, actually.
Yeah, I mean, that was, I don't know, I think I get a lot of questions about that. Vikings, they never spoke English. So no matter what I do, unless I go back to school and get a degree in ancient Scandinavian language, I'm going to have to, guess.
Sure.
And everything I write is, a translation, basically.
Sure.
So at that point, I just have to figure out what I'm going to do. You know, I mean, I'm not going to write it like a Thor.
Right, you know? Right.
I'm not going to do that. There were, a lot of them, because I read a lot of other fiction about that. And there's, that guy, George R. Martin.
Sure.
Writes in English, but then every so often he'll insert, a random foreign language word.
Okay.
Or something.
Sure, sure.
Which I drove me up a wall. So then there's also I don't know the right word for it, but this little elegant way of speaking in Lord of the Rings. Right? And I just sat back and thought about it, and I'm I'm writing about people that can't read, right? Who live in some far corner of the world. They're not educated. Where are they going to learn to speak like that? You know, they're going to speak it, and their vocabulary is a lot more limited back then. So I figure they're going to speak really bluntly and directly, and everybody swears from the beginning of time until now. So that's kind of that was that thought process. It took me about a week to work through all of that, you know. And I wrote a lot of failed attempts at scripts, trying different things out, and what I ended up with was honestly what I thought was the best thing to do, you know, given what I was trying to achieve.
And modern dialogue, you same thing. What I your answer to me, Brian, if you wouldn't mind, was just get on a bus.
Well, yeah, that's something. The most important thing about dialogue is that it emotionally rings true when it's being said. You know, that's what you gotta really, you know, pay attention to when you're writing, I think.
Okay. So you had a question?
I had a question. Especially for Esperella, which is rarely do you ever use a narration box. So do you find it hard to make it sound like someone is speaking, but also give enough information to the story?
No. No, I don't. That's, I mean, it's a challenge to move a story along without caption boxes, that kind of stuff, but we don't have those in real life either, you know? Plots get moved by what people say to each other. You know, if you take that kind of tact with approaching a story, you know, it's not too hard to, you know. But then I read a lot of plays, so I guess I'm coming from that kind of thought process as well.
How much information do you give your artists in terms of like what kind of emotion you're trying to convey, just that close up of someone's face?
Hopefully, I mean, with the silent panels, hopefully that the artists understand what the characters are thinking by what they've said previously, or what the scene, what's going on in the scene. You know, usually I don't have a problem. I mean, Eduardo reads my mind as far, you know, as that goes on, 100 bullets. It's like, I don't have to write art direction in 100 bullets. Or I could just send him a script and I get back with, you know, exactly what I was thinking.
How much personal interface have you had with Eduardo through the years?
Not much.
Yeah. You know, email through translation and...
Yeah. I mean, we email each other a few times a month. When he needs script, he emails me, tells me he needs script. But, you know, I guess we met face-to-face maybe 4 or 5 times.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's cool. Sir?
I have one question that I think kind of has a little bit of dialogue, but it's about the way you read comics. Because my whole family, the way you read comics, is when I read something, I do the whistle in my head. When I read it, I was wondering if you guys did. I was wondering if that was a normal thing, or if some people are just missing out on one of the coolest things in comics.
Doing the voices?
Yeah, like, when you know, when you're reading, all the characters are the same. Like, if you were to read something out loud,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, when a teacher reads their, like, say, grade class or
something. Right.
Characters. I do that kind of thing in my head. But when the partner's talking, it's different than when some lady is saying, or, you know, trying not to kill is talking.
Sure.
Uh-huh.
So I'm wondering if you guys did the voices in your head when you were reading comics.
I actually speak when I'm writing, so, you know. I do the voices out loud, so I'm crazier than you are.
Well, actually, that leads me to another question. Would you normally, would you write how the characters are saying it, like if they had an accent, would you write the accent, or would you, like, all the way, like, sometimes that could be sometimes a little hindering, like, if you were to write in an accent and people, it's sometimes hard, or do you kind of imply it or sometimes put it and leave it to other people to do that? Because sometimes I do that as well. They have an accent some places, I put it other places, but I also understand that they wouldn't write it all the time because sometimes it just becomes a hindrance. What are you saying?
I write accents, totally. I love doing it too. But if it doesn't look right, if a word or a combination of words don't look right, because you're reading it, so it's visual, I'll change it, you know.
I mean, I think there's ways to write accents just by how you put a sentence together, as opposed to like that period of time when I wrote Generation X at Marvel, there was that, blanking on his name, the Irish guy. I don't know, and like a lot of like the Marvel writers like spell the words as if it was like in an Irish accent, and I think the only person that can really do that is Garth Ennis with Cassidy and Preacher and not have it be as silly.
Yeah, I mean, like that, like sometimes people go through it, but sometimes you know the origin of that person is that they're Irish or that they're German.
I think it's really hard. I didn't know you ever did that.
What,
Ryan? Wrote accents or
Write
it like that.
Wrote accents?
Yeah.
Well, let's see. I've got an Irish character in Loveless who's, you know, he speaks.
No, maybe that's good because it doesn't, like, jump off the page at me.
Well, no, I don't want it to jump off the and, God, every clunky way. We're Dr. 13, everybody had an accent. but I was doing that, you know, that was supposed to be clunky. It's just supposed to be, you know, Captain Fear was like sounded like Ricky Ricardo.
Well, and the Marvel White Tiger, and I don't mean to pick on the woman who wrote that, but it almost, the description you gave where you occasionally put an actual authentic foreign word in there, it just seemed a little too obvious, and it was kind of, it was a way that I had never heard a Hispanic person speak,
mm-hmm.
but it was like this in this comic book to remind you, she's Spanish, mm-hmm. she's Spanish. And it's like, yeah, okay, we get that. You know, again, I'm not trying to pick on it.
No, and I definitely write slang. I mean, the throw.
Well, and that's the great, like, that's what I noticed when I, on my first interview with you, Chicago's being a multicultural city and stuff. I mean, you're getting a nice cross-section of really people from different backgrounds and getting real rhythms of how inner-city people speak to each other and everything, I think.
Yes.
I got a question. I have a question actually from what? Reading each Channel Zero and DMZ, you know, both very seem very socially and politically charged, have a very charged message. Do you feel that the story in each Channel Zero and DMZ is indicative of where we are currently as a nation, even with metaphorically, with the way that we're very politically galvanized, and you know, kind of blind to what's going on around us? Or do you feel that that's possibly something that's growing in the near distant future, realistically?
Both those books have some common ideas. But they come from very different places, and I feel like I was almost two different people working on those. Channel Zero was the classic angry art student screed, you know, and it is what it is. I used to try to, like, you know, talk my way out of that, you know, but after a while, it's like, you know, that's what I was at the time, so that's what it is. And it was also very local. It was very much about, like the politics in New York City as they affected a white art student. You know, in 1997, like, I was very, very focused on what I was doing. DMZ is fun because I can sort of, like, not, like, go back in time and, like, do it over again, because that's not what I was trying to do, but I could sort of, like, go back and take another look at some, like, general themes, you know, as someone very, very different. And very, very much affected by, like, global politics. You know, it was almost like 10 years of thinking about Channel Zero ends up with DMZ. And I don't write it as, like, a future thing. I think a lot of people might not even... I mean, I was very careful at the beginning that, like, unlike a book like Transmat, like, nothing is going to look like it's from the future in the book. Like, in a lot of cases, I made things look old, like all the cameras are old 35mm cameras, because that felt like it wore a photographer more than like a little
digital
box, you know. So, and I think that's, for me anyway, that's how I want to try to connect the audiences with the story, is try to make it look as much like real life as I can. I don't know if I answered your question or not.
I think you did.
I guess my second question would have been, going back to Channel Zero, that's honestly one of my favorite shows, and it's both the writing and I think your art style behind it.
Thank you.
Do you think you have any kind of wants or would you consider that you're too doing a book that's all your own again?
Yeah, I think the only reason why I stopped, well, there's a couple reasons why I stopped trying to draw comics, and I started to get really slow. I was really fast. When I was in school and I was working on Channel Zero, I was like doing like four pages a day, and then I got a job and slowed way down. And so I think if I was going to do a book like that again, if I was going to draw like that length of a book, we're talking like 2.5 years, you know, working on it, which I'm not, you know. I'm not ready to do. And I also just don't think that this industry really really wants me as an artist. Because I've tried to get a lot of work doing covers or something, and it's like, you know, turn down constantly. Yeah. And then I do some art on DMZ, which is nice. And I think it kind of makes sense there, but I just think that's passed me by, being an artist.
And as I know, you said you left your painting behind a while ago, as far as it would never even figured into your comic book.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Well, writing scratches the creative itch. You know?
Yeah. No, I understand. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I know Brahm is setting up, so I want to wrap this up and give you guys an opportunity. I know that to say what's coming up. Are any new trades coming up? Baz, are we due for a new
Jesus. Let's see. El Diablo's coming out next week.
Yeah. Oh, awesome. Yeah. Fantastic.
I can't wait.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It's been a long time coming. Yeah. I don't know if there's another 100 Bullets trade. I mean, there will be. I don't know when it is.
And I thought I saw in previews that the next Loveless trade is.
Yeah, that's probably coming out pretty soon.
I think it's in the current previews, guys, so the January previews, so you might want to check that out.
And then a Joker graphic novel be out in the spring. I did that with Lieber Mayo, the same person I worked on Luther with. It's going to be hardcover. Expensive.
Brian Wood?
I have DMZ trades out in March and I think the end of June, DMZ 4 and 5.
And Northlanders 2 just came out a week or so, or a couple weeks ago.
Northlanders comes out in the first week of each month.
Okay.
So 3's coming up soon.
Oh, great.
There's the Vertigo issue demo that's going to be out in May.
Okay.
The Minx book that I wrote with Ryan Kelly.
Oh, cool.
That comes out in June or July. It's called the New York 4. There's something else I'm missing, too. I think around that time, summertime, the local trade will finally be out.
Excellent. Fantastic. Yeah, we didn't even talk about local, and that's another awesome.
Oh, man.
That's Thank awesome. That, truly, that's been another
great book. I love that book, but it'll be fantastic when it's done. We had a really rough time with that, with scheduling.
I understand.
As everybody knows.
Jeez. We'll wrap it up. I want to thank the Bryans. They are here for the rest of today and tomorrow as well. Make sure you stop by their booths and check out their stuff.
That's Brian Wood and Brian Azzarello from the FX International Convention. And do yourself a favor, check out their website, fxshow.com. Again, more coverage of the convention as the week goes on. You're going to hear from a lot of my favorite creators, people like Jill Thompson, Dan Brereton, Phil Noto, B. Clay Moore, Jeremy Hahn, Seth Peck, Freddie Williams, Gene Ha. Really was a great convention. And I had a lot of time to spend to talk to all these guys. And you're going to be hearing about all the coverage this week from Word Balloon. Word Balloon is brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. InStock Trades offers a huge selection of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more. They're all at up to 35% off, with orders over $50 receiving free shipping. Right now, you'll find many of Brian Azzarello's 100 Bullets trades, which sell regularly for $14.99. They're only $9.74 at InStockTrades.com. Plus, Brian Wood's DMZ trades retail for $12.99, just $8.44 at InStockTrades. And don't forget to visit their sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, at DCBService.com for all your pre-order needs. Major publishers are 40% off, and monthly specials are 45 to 75% off every month. Visit InStockTrades at InStockTrades.com and Discount Comic Book Service at DCBService.com. Thanks again for listening. This is John Suntress. Keep listening to Word Balloon. You can find us here at Newsarama, also at iTunes, at our MySpace page, myspace.com/wordballoon, at comicspace.com/wordballoon, at Podcast Alley, Podcast Pickle, all the various podcatching sites you should be able to find, and subscribe to our RSS feed, because really you'll find access to over 100 different Word Balloon episodes featuring interviews with many of your favorite creators. So until next time, thanks for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2008.